These are the ones tracking the process. The telephones, the airlines, the airports. And I'm sure by the end of this parliament, this is the person who's made the electricity again. Finally, the cost of the state services. And here, the research has been done now. Procedures by which choice and opportunity can be obtained. All in all, the cumulative growth that I think represents the biggest rolling back.
So you will not change anything if you to nationalize services and industries, to private them without letting in competition.
That's very good for us. And if I let it on this now, the role which the regulatory process plays in this. If you have a project which is allegedly controlled by a government regulatory body, what actually happens, of course, is that little two-step that I described earlier in local government, that the regulatory body, while ostensibly controlling the monopoly, in fact, is set. And the regulatory body acts in such a way to prevent the entry of competitors into the system. So the important lesson to learn from that is that one should not have any such regulatory body, and that a private monopoly has the advantage that it can be broken technologically. New products and processes can be used to break the private monopoly. Normally, with a public monopoly, they are not allowed. The government will, in fact, protect its state monopoly by legislation. The classic example would be in the case of the telephone service in Britain, where the Post Office Monopoly Act, which actually prohibits the use of handbells signaling to people across a hill. That is a
thank you. one of the methods of creating employment in a very fast way is, of course, the enterprise zones and the free ports. What is the next step after these first two have been taken with daring success?
The question I'll ask whether or not employment can be generated by enterprise owners and free ports and then follow on up next. It's a very shrewd question. This recognizes that free ports, like that, are not like the enterprise owner act, and the first flight has failed. The attempt was to draw the slate to be a motion to see what enterprise ability could do on them. The concept that Professor Peter Paul introduced with his idea of was to create an e-com company to reproduce the freedom of enterprise, which enabled one with no resources to establish the economy fit. And the theory was this could be reproduced selectively in certain areas. It's a very good thing, and who knows, it may work, but that's a never going to turn. Because what we got in this was an old game which is known as regional development. It's also known by the old name, which would be drawing meters. People were sort of cracking in this. It was basically aiming to play. You had to draw some rain on every hand, going to another, they said. So those who were running for it. I'm sure the enterprise zones do sound good. I'm sure they generate something to draw. And for that, it should be praised. They commended the leadership. It is, however, a less spectacular leadership than we were looking to promise when the idea was first moved. And it is possible that the same might be said of free ports. So the answer is that yes, experiments of that kind are valuable. It's good micro-projects show the advantage of success on a small scale and then extend it. Because if you want to talk about some new approach, what would really happen to the degradation? Would people be too effective in the middle of residential area? Not in a particular space, as in an enterprise zone and free port, but in a particular sector of the economy. Identify small businesses as the one most affected by regulation, the one that higher corporate costs are not liable, and yet the one which can generate new jobs, sectors generate usually new jobs in that in the last 4 years. If you look at that sector and give it the same kind of assistance as given to enterprise zones and free port, then you might not be looking at some success.
Decided I think it was pretty well unanimous assent on this, that we would create a libertarian organization as an entrepreneurial organization owned by Bruce Peaboy and myself, and that we would encourage other groups to set up similar organizations. Now, our position was more or less to spawn these organizations, and I think that if there is one thing that's valid about the statist, or not statist, but the collectivist, communist form of organization, is the cell system, where they have small groups, and they decentralize the power and the control. And so if there are groups who are interested in infiltrating and subverting and seizing power, that is immensely difficult for them to do so. It's been very difficult for people, and there have been many, who tried to subvert the activities of the international, and it's been virtually impossible. And I think if we can maintain the same structure that we have, if we can keep things fairly small with a minimum of organizational structure, and I'm not in this manner suggesting in any way that we shouldn't have long-term goals or have staff of any kind to establish these goals, but I think we should try to encourage the growth through IAC spontaneous order, that the evolution of groups in different countries, groups that will be associated and affiliated with us on a strictly voluntary basis and will be totally autonomous and self-controlling. And I think this is the only way that we can be assured that there will be a healthy growth in the movement. And I think that's all I'm going to say. And I'm sure that there are lots of good ways in which we can market and promote the libertarian movement internationally within this context. And I'm going to turn the program now over to Don Hoffman.
Volunteer for anything, but I thought something should be said about marketing and advertising, which is my field. I'm Don Hoffman. I'm a copywriter and consultant. What I do is direct response, direct marketing. That's the kind of junk mail you get in your mailbox, any kind of ad with a coupon on it that asks you for money. And I haven't done a lot of fundraising work in a few years, but I still follow it and I still give advice to people for free and for money. If I had known I was going to be talking, I would have brought copious notes, handouts for everyone, but just a few minutes ago, I scribbled everything I have to say on the back of the proverbial envelope left. And if you have any questions, maybe there'll be some time afterward or come to see me anytime during the course of the conference. We're talking here about paid advertising and public relations, running an ad, getting a letter out, finding a mailing list. I mean, let's do a whole conference just on that. But I'll restrict myself to what I see as the major issues. One of the biggest problems I find with any kind of political or fundraising advertising or cause advertising is the lack of some sort of concept. The most common kind of advertisement that you see of this sort says, vote for our candidate, or open letter from the People's Republic of Romania. It's that kind of very dull, academic, textbooky kind of material that doesn't get your attention, doesn't create excitement and stir your juices and get somebody to take out their checkbook and give you money. It's ironic because we're dealing with very exciting ideas. We're literally ideas that are supposed to be changing the world. They're radical, they're different, they're controversial, and yet you see this very dull kind of advertising for major political parties, for causes, for charitable groups, and so on. And you need a certain amount of creativity and excitement to get people to pay attention. In America, people have calculated that every single citizen is bombarded with about 1,500 advertising messages per day. And what happens is that the individual tunes out most of it. He just doesn't see it. And if he doesn't see it, he's certainly not going to have his thoughts changed. He's not going to respond. He's not going to send you your literature or send you money or whatever you want him to do. A couple of examples. I did an ad some years ago for a group called Council for Competitive Economy. So at least one person in this room will remember that. And the headline we came up with were a full-page ad that ran in the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers said, "Are America's businessmen cutting their own throats?" The idea was that, I think you all understand what we were getting at, here are these heads of big corporations that were pleading for subsidies and special favors, and they wanted things from government and where they were justifying the tax system or the regulations. Maybe it helped them, maybe it didn't, but we had a whole list of horror stories of major corporate people who presumably should be in favor of the free market and capitalism, and here they were defending these horrendous interventionist and statist and socialist kinds of things. So that was, we thought, a kind of snappy headline, or America's businessmen cutting their own throats. That would be a little better than an open letter from someone to someone else. National Taxpayers Union, which some of you may know, it's a huge organization in the States, which is, they don't like to style themselves libertarian, but in many ways they are. And I didn't do this for them, but one of the most successful mailings they've been doing for something like 5, 7, 8 years, you get this envelope in the mail that says your statement is enclosed. Statement is like a bill, for those of you who don't know it, and you open it up and you find it's the national debt and broken down by, you know, divided by population to show you that your share of the national debt is $112,000 or so, and at least it was back then. Very successful. I mean, they've been mailing it, and it's been making money for them for many, many years, and that in itself is unusual. I recall an ad for when a political candidate ran in New York, a libertarian candidate, and the headline was, "Keep politicians out of your bedroom." That's going to get some attention. So now, what we look for is the unique selling proposition. Just about a month ago, a man named Russell Reeves died, who was one of the great American advertising pioneers. That was his phrase, USP. Unique selling proposition. We've certainly all got it, and the point is to sit down, formulate a strategy, translate it into some sort of attention-getting concept or headline or lead paragraph of a letter, and you know, that's, I think, half the battle, at least creatively, to getting people to respond to you. The second point I wanted to make is that all of what I do is direct marketing, direct response work. This is the kind of advertising, as I said, where you get an immediate response. There's a telephone number, an address, an envelope to send things back. I don't do the kinds of advertising you see in the magazines, which is just for a beer or an automobile, and, you know, because nobody can quantify that. Nobody can figure out how many cans of beer that's going to sell. But one of the things I tell people is that every issue, cause, political ad, whatever you want to call it, should be a direct response kind of ad. Have some sort of coupon they can tear out or form they can send back saying, "Here's my money, send me more information, count on me." Capture their name. Once you get that name, it belongs to you. Mailing lists are very expensive. You go out to rent lists of names, you're paying a lot of money. But once you get somebody to give you his name, her name voluntarily, you own that name. And then you can continue to mail to those individuals, get more money, even rent those names to other people, and it becomes a source of revenue. So one of the most important things for any cause or organization or charity is what we call a house list, names that belong to you. You don't have to pay for them. These are your friends, your donors, people who've expressed some interest. That's a very important point. Third point I'd like to make in your advertising and public relations and fundraising is the element of human interest. Everybody was very critical of each other this morning. Perhaps I can say that one of the things that bothered me was that all three talks were on a very abstract level, and I never heard any real concrete. What does this mean to human beings? I would have liked to hear some examples in practice involving actual people of how all those very broad idealistic suggestions would be implemented. I mean, after all, today's the day for tactics. So one of the things I tell all my clients, most of my work is for publishers, newsletter people, magazine people, book people, try to get some human interest into your writing. For example, suppose in my country we were dealing with the taxes and regulations that keep small business people in trouble, all of the paperwork they have to submit to the OSHA, the FTC, all of these alphabet soup agencies that tell them what to do. Well, suppose we could have found a story of one individual who was driven out of business by all of these regulations and tell his story. I mean, that would be very dramatic. We wouldn't have to look far for such anecdotes. But that would be much more interesting to the reader than just to listen to a long dissertation out of an academic pamphlet about the alleged harm of government regulations. When you bring things from the ivory tower level down to the level of concrete individuals, that's when the average person can identify. He says, "This is a person like me. This could happen to me." Or I identify with him just as another human being, which I believe was something that was said yesterday morning. So you have to, that's another very, very common failing in any kind of issue or cause, or in fact any kind of advertising. You always want to bring things down and people are people. They're, you know, they their own lives involve themselves and other human beings. That's what they can identify with. Finally, I wanted to say something about public relations. Again, this is, I'm spreading over huge areas very quickly. Public relations is what's sometimes called free advertising. It's the editorial material. If you pay to run an ad in a magazine, that's advertising, paid advertising. If you can get yourself into the editorial columns, that's what we call public relations or publicity. There are pros and cons to this. I happen to think, I don't practice public relations, but I know people who do, and I think PR is a very important part of any program. Number one, you don't pay for it. If you're doing the work yourselves, if you're calling these editors, writing them letters, it's not like spending hundreds or thousands of dollars or pounds or shekels or whatever your currency is to run an ad. Also, it's much more credible. When people buy a magazine, let's say, they're buying the magazine to read the editorial material. They're not buying it for the ads. They'll try to avoid reading the ads. So if you can get a story written about your cause, your problem, your situation, what you're fighting for, that is much more believable, much stronger than running an advertisement in the same magazine. The only problem is, of course, that the story is only going to run once. The ad can run as many times as you give the money to do so. But that's why I tell my clients, take that article and then recycle it, reprint it, quote it, and you can even include it perhaps with a mailing that you make to raise funds, and circle the key paragraphs. And when you show that article with the name of the magazine, that suddenly gives you credibility. They might say, well, if they were in the London Times or in Time Out or in the New York Times or whatever the publication is, the publication they recognize, that gives you the imprimatur and the approval of a known and respected media. So that gives you a certain amount of credibility that you wouldn't have otherwise. So I regard public relations, the editorial side, and paid advertising, fundraising, as really two sides of the same coin. They should interact, and they're not really mutually exclusive. I think that's pretty much everything. As I say, I'm just ad-libbing from my memory, even memory is not one of my strongest points, but if our powers that be will allow questions now, I can take them, or collar me at some point on the trip. Rest of the conference, I'll be around largely in the morning toward noon. I'm going to take off for London and play hooky from the conference. Thank you.
I understand she was chanting at the bit to be able to say what she wanted to say. Just talk to her.
Actually, what I wanted to do was throw out an idea, and then in the course of this week, get your reactions to it. It's something that I've been thinking about because the situation in the United States, the electoral politics. You can't hear me? The electoral politics haven't been working out too well recently. We've been running lots of candidates and our budgets have been shrinking and so forth. What I want to say first is, how many of you have heard of the ACLU, the American Civil Rights Union? Okay, well, let me explain what it is. Now, well, first let me tell you, the reason I want to explain what it is because this idea was sort of inspired by them, but I am not endorsing them here, okay? But the American Civil Liberties Union is a group of people, many of them lawyers, who donate their services, many of them people who join and give money and get newsletters and so forth, who support individuals whose rights have been violated, at least in the civil liberties realm. Or at least in theory, that's what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, they've been going, they haven't been doing that lately, but that's the theory behind it. So that if I'm being, if I've been arrested for resisting registration for the draft, I can call up the American Civil Liberties Union and say, will you defend me? And they usually say yes. And they've been doing this for a long time, and they've built up for themselves a very good reputation because they actually help individual people in distress because the rights have been violated. And they argue their cases on a strict constitutional First Amendment sort of basis. They go for the idea of free speech, for example. Libertarians in various communities all over the place. And when people in that community hear about some sort of rights violation, some old woman is being kicked out of her house by eminent domain, they say, we'll help you. They might contribute legal advice. They might defend the woman. They might fundraise. And when I say fundraise with these issues, I'm talking about not fundraise just for libertarians. I'm talking about fundraise in that community. Because when you get something like that happening in a community, often people in that community, they want to help. I mean, this happens all the time. Somebody, for all sorts of issues, somebody's child needs to have a liver transplant surgery, and it's very expensive. Often people in the community will donate all the money that's necessary to do the operation. I mean, this happens in the United States a lot. I assume it happens elsewhere. So Nadia was saying the other day in Australia, there was a case of a Melbourne hardware store owner who was fined $500,000 for opening his store on Sunday. Okay? And what they're doing is they're raising money to help him pay his fine. And they're getting a lot of media attention.
That's right.
So now, the thing is, when you do something like this, you've helped some people directly whose rights have been violated. people in the community start to hear about them, become interested. Like, why are these people doing this? What are they up to? What does it have to do with? You develop media contacts. Local, at least in the United States, the media seems to be much more interested in action.
To illustrate the sort of range that in practical terms, libertarian ideas can be developed and communicated. And before doing so, I'd like to say this. I think it's important that people do what they enjoy and what they're good at. I think the idea that there is one answer, and that one answer should be followed by people whether they might enjoy it or not, or like doing it or not, is just a bad idea.
Yep.
You know, there are an enormous range of ways of libertarian ideas and attitudes and techniques can be developed and promulgated. Let's give you a few examples of this. At the LA 84 LA Super Bowl, there was a superb Apple commercial. The Apple commercial took the following form. Beautiful young lady is running along, carrying a sledgehammer. She's being pursued by thuggish pursuing thought police. The camera then cuts back to a huge meeting hall. There's an enormous video screen, big Big Brother there droning away. Audience in brainwashed clothes sitting there, you know, being brainwashed. Yeah. Young lady just manages to evade the thuggish pursuing thought police as she comes into the hall and flings the sledgehammer straight through the screen. Yeah. Every libertarian I know who saw that experienced a feeling of exultation. Yeah, it cost Apple $900,000 to put it on. There was no mention of computers anywhere in the thing.
Yeah.
And The Economist picked it up and, you know, mentioned the point that it was directed by Ridley Scott, who was, you know, an excellent British film director. And that advertisement certainly communicated part of the spirit of libertarian ideas. Yeah. There's an outfit up in Washington State called First Earth Battalion Foundation, which exists basically to develop and promulgate a variety of individualist-oriented ideas within the U.S. Armed Services, so that the U.S. Armed Services are less a hierarchic, rigid, dehumanized organization, but becomes more effective by being more individualistic, by having moral responsibility in what it does. And they emphasize the idea of individual moral responsibility very strongly. And they spread those ideas very effectively with the cooperation of the U.S. Armed Services and branches of the U.S. Armed Services. In the United Kingdom, recently, the docks in the United Kingdom are substantially controlled by a state of sub-licensing program to the unions called the Dock Labour Board system. And the Dock Labour Union, in support of the Mine Workers Union, announced that they were closing the docks to give solidarity with their communist friends of the Miners Union. And the free market truckers, self-employed truckers, who were stuck in Dover and were unable to carry on their business because of this obstruction, told the port authorities that within 24 hours, if this strike wasn't abandoned, they were going to burn the entire port down. And the problem is that under the present British administration, you can't try this under every administration, yeah? But under the present British administration, it is not unsympathetic to the idea of that particular strike being defeated. So, you know, the police just stood by and watched, but the people made it quite clear they were going to burn the whole bloody place down if necessary, and the strike was called off. 24 hours later, the strike was called off. Give you another example. One of the great difficulties. One of the great difficulties that individuals face when confronting organs of the state, you know, is that the organs of the state are very large and very strong, and the individual is not very strong. Increasingly, both in the United Kingdom and in the United States, there are commercial insurance organisations, which in return for a small premium provide legal support services, publicity services, and so on to individuals who are abused by the state, whether it's the tax authorities, particular government departments abusing their business. I'd recommend to your attention the work done under the Neotech program by Frank Wallace. Frank Wallace is simply the world's best poker player, and has elaborated a system of ideas which is very, very strongly libertarian in content. You find full-page reviews in National Review, in Reason, and a number of publications. And he again provides a whole arsenal of techniques that can be used by individuals, basically to see through the government, yeah? To see its weaknesses, to see through the political situation. Yeah? And what I'd like to suggest really is that you look at a whole range of techniques which you can use in whatever particular area of activity that you choose to do, to increase your ability and power to do it and to communicate. And on a last note, you know, I think this is an important thing to understand. An awful lot of the people you think of as your enemies, and at present are your enemies in practical terms, you know, the people obstructing progress towards a libertarian society, you know, rather than basically destroying your enemies, it is infinitely easier to turn them into your friends. Yeah, and you would be surprised the extent to which a great many people within existing state structures, you know, which are obstructive and unpleasant and authoritarian, can in fact become very sympathetic, you know, if you cease automatically treating them as enemies.
In Australia, which runs a bookshop and also tries to get libertarian ideas across to very ordinary people. So we were already interested in ways of getting to the community. We had already been the practice of putting out press releases on supporting certain individuals, and they did tend to get published. In this particular case, as I was telling Lino about, the Melbourne businessman was fined, and we publicly said we'd launch a campaign to raise money for him. We got a fantastic press conference. We got our first television coverage as a new organisation. We didn't get such good newspaper coverage in Sydney, although we got good coverage in Melbourne. And from that I could conclude that the media were not biased against us in the fact that they had publicised what we'd done on television, but in some way we had failed to put our message across in the right fashion for the newspapers. And I think that highlights one of the problems of libertarians. We tend to assume that the media is against our principles, and I'm not sure that's necessarily so. I think the newspapers are used to dealing professionals, people who know how to get a message across, and we tend to be amateurs and not to look at our methods rather than our principles. What else are we going to say about what happened? One important point was that you mentioned forming a network to start with. Now, we found that you don't actually need a network to start with necessarily. We chose an issue, and it came on us by accident, and it was a perfect issue because it needed very little funding. It had already had some national coverage. And what we found was that when you've chosen your issue carefully and you've got good coverage from it, people will come to you with their issues rather than you having to have a network out to spot issues. We found as well it was a very good way of bringing in very ordinary people, not activists or interest groups, just people from the street who thought that what we were doing was a good thing, that even if they were actually against weekend trading themselves, because they couldn't see themselves working on Sundays, they felt that a $500,000 fine was ridiculous. And from that point, they were asking us what our other aims and ideas were. The only negative point we did have was that the media were initially suspicious that we were taking up the issue and were questioning our motivation. Were we trying to jump on the bandwagon into some victim's unfortunate circumstances? We were lucky in that we were able to say that we had previously had lots of contact with the man through our Libertarian Dinner Club down in Melbourne, and that sort of allayed any sort of suspicion. So that's one thing that would probably well to bear in mind. I think those are the only point I'd make. Yeah, yes, it's something that we have worked out for ourselves and it seems to be working. And I'm sure we can do it.
Coverage, both on television and in the newspapers. And a few points about this. Don't try too hard. Like most things in life, you succeed best at what you don't try to do. And by, in fact, not trying to get publicity, we, in fact, got lots more publicity than we ever did when we were really trying. Which is not to say that you shouldn't put out press releases and so on, but don't be too heavy, don't be too obvious, don't make it very clear that you're desperate for coverage. Act as if, in fact, you've got something that they ought to want and they ought to report, or something that they can make use of. Always remember, and forget the bias thing. We all know the press is biased, you know. Everyone is biased in favour of their own views. But remember, they're also doing a job, and they want stories, and they want interesting things. And a lot of things libertarians do, not all of them, are interesting. Sometimes, too, they'll want actually to make fun of you. But that can be worthwhile, because, you know, almost any publicity is a good publicity, as long as they don't actually say you're fascist or something, you know. But a lot of, I'm not quite sure what to say in the American press, but there are diary columns in the major British national newspapers, either Times, Daily Telegraph and The Guardian, which are little humorous pieces, political comments and so on, and they run almost every day, and they constantly want humorous stories. Now, we now have a personal contact with a guy who does The Times diary column, and we feed him bits of humorous information about nothing connected to libertarianism, just silly political things or little stories we've heard about and so on. And then every so often, you know, he gives us a plug, you know, just a straight plug, maybe a humorous plug, you know, but it's all helpful. We in fact now reach a position where the media approaches us for stories. I mean, I've got a contact on Yorkshire Independent Television, and twice he's approached me about programmes, not me approaching him. Well, one didn't come off, but it may come off sometime in the future. A second one, in fact, they actually wanted a female libertarian, so we hunted around to appear on a programme to talk about surrogate motherhood and so on. And we packed the little lady off, you know, we told her what to say. Seriously. Anyway, she went off, they paid for it to go right up to the north of England and to go on to this programme. And actually, ironically, in the end, there was a last-minute change of plan. And in fact, they had her in the studio, but they didn't actually film anything she said. But then they paid for a taxi all the way back down to London again. However, the point is that and they paid her, and plus expenses. You know, this will happen again. Next time she'll be on. We've now been asked again for there's a Channel 4, who in fact the people who are filming here today, well, this is something separate, but another programme on Channel 4 has a brief 5-minute comment slot about 8 o'clock in the evening, in which someone just comes into the studio and does a talking heads job about something in the news. And again, they've approached us about this, and also interestingly enough, they actually want libertarian women especially, because they can get any number of left-wing women, but there's, you know, a drastic shortage of women to put non-socialist views across. So again, we've given them names and so on, and things will be happening on that. And I think it is worth emphasising, you know, an inch of press coverage in a story is worth thousands, millions in terms of advertising. I find this again and again and again in the bookshop as well as just the Libertarian Alliance. You know, one line, you know, in Daily Telegraph, they mentioned the bookshop in one of the editorials just as an aside. You know, and that day you get sort of 20 people coming in who've never heard of you. And that really pays off. So don't be hostile to the press. Think about their needs all the time. Think about what they want in every way. Be helpful. Be helpful on other things. I mean, we've got a number of press people who just come to us for stories on other things, contacts, and phone us up for information. We know a lot about, you know, the political spectrum. We work with lots of different people. They phone up and say, you know, what about so-and-so group? Or what about such-and-such group? What do you know about them? You know? And we give them some information, you know, and then it pays off in the long run. So be helpful to the press, cultivate contacts, don't be obsequious, but just be helpful, be nice, be absolutely frank about it. Don't treat them as hostile. Be nice to the socialist press as well, because coverage in the socialist press can pay off. We've now had good coverage, you know, in a number of socialist magazines. An error I've seen a lot in the American libertarian movement, I hope the Americans will forgive me for saying this, but they're too optimistic in the short run, and which creates, in the end, pessimism in that short run, and they hope to get enormous press coverage immediately rather than just doing the long slog, building up the track record, and things come. I mean, they're now coming to us in Britain, you know, after something like 15 years of being in the wilderness, and suddenly in the last few years things really started to move in every way, membership, press coverage, books. I've been trying to get books published for the last 15 years, you know. This year, someone approaches me and asks me to do one, and I sign the contract, you know, and they're interested in the second one. I've got so many requests to do articles, I can't keep up with it. And the media coverage and so on, and requests to attend meetings, we're now, Brian, myself, other speakers are constantly being asked. We could do a meeting, you know, a month to every other group, more than that probably, and turn things down now. So everything's coming together, so just sort of hang in there. I don't know, be good guys.
it's
maybe it's up there.
Oh.
At the end of the street.
Okay.
This way.
Okay.
Come
on. Hotel.
Yep.
Okay. That's it? Okay. I got it. Thanks for this. See you later.
Okay.
Okay.
Turn the ball around. 你講句說話，我一句都聽唔到。 我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，我都要走了，
Do these cost very much in Hong Kong?
Pardon?
How much do these, how many Hong Kong dollars do these cost?
Nominees, 1,200.
I think they are much more in Australia.
Is it? Yeah, some are Australia.
Fuck you, I'm sorry. 佢飲啤酒啊，人哋話支好撚大，半杯都唔得啊！我都話，我喺呢度開始飲酒啊嘛，喺呢度喺呢度再飲多，再飲多，飲多啲啊！哇！你
Remarkable visit to a Japanese restaurant in Hong Kong. Can't mention the name of the Japanese restaurant, but I can't read the sign. Well, what a remarkable evening that was. All I did was race back to the hotel room to get my tape recorder to take a couple of sounds of the Chinese on the underground railway here, and somehow I managed to get back to the hotel room about 5 hours later. So, hope I make it for the plane in the morning.
Future sewer workers who didn't need much brains were produced on low levels of oxygen. Persons were induced to love their assigned status in the regime by the use of Pavlovian conditioning techniques, and by sleep teaching, and by a wondrous soma drug. Most of the techniques that Huxley fantasized for the distant future are already becoming available now. The rise of technology has been far more rapid than Orwell could have suspected, and it has taken forms he couldn't have predicted. Already there are devices for pacifying troubled people, some people and dissenters. For a time, brain operations like prefrontal lobotomies were popular, but now drugs are used because they're cheaper and can be used on a day-to-day basis. People can be kept under surveillance by locking transmitters to their bodies. Subhumans can even be created for doing menial work as a source of spare parts for human bodies. The ancient Stoics used to say, surrender everything you have if you have to, except your will. People may injure your body, but don't let them injure your spirit. Even if you are sick or in pain, this need not affect you. Keep intact your inviolable will. Heroic words. But modern technology has made it possible to break the will. Tortures can be inflicted such as virtually nobody can resist. And anyway, various forms of truth serum can be forcibly injected so that you can't help revealing the truth under their influence, no matter how much you may try to hide it. The will itself can be broken. But a much simpler way has come to view. We can reshape people so that they don't want to resist. We are becoming capable of genetic engineering that will produce whatever kind of people the rulers want. Maya Pines, in her book, The Brain Changers, writes, quote, in France, where generations of peasant women have painstakingly force-fed geese by hand to fatten them for good foie gras, surgeons have begun to take over the jobs, performing a delicate operation on the geese's hypothalamus to knock out their centers of society. This makes the geese speak incessantly of their own free will, so to speak, damaging their insides and consuming as much as when they were stuffed by hand. To top it all, a drug company is now developing a chemical that can be injected directly into the animal's brain to produce the same effect in only a few minutes at negligible cost. And she adds, quote, there is something particularly revolting about these self-stuffing geese. Surely the American scientists who investigated the brain mechanisms responsible for appetite and satiety should have foreseen such applications of their work. It makes one wonder how our own brains may someday be changed, and for whose benefit. What may all this research do to human beings, she asks, unquote. Peace-loving rats that grew up in a laboratory have been turned instantly into killers by injecting certain drugs into the hypothalamus. The transmitter acetylcholine caused the release of aggression. In other rats, the scientists inserted tiny hollow tubes into the rats' brains, and then they put in a few drops of carbachol. The rats pounded on the mice and killed them with a single hard bite, their first murder. And then the scientists found chemicals that would turn off the killer attacks. Methyl-atropine caused the wild rats to suddenly become pacifists, walking to the mice, sniffing them, doing nothing else. Dr. Douglas Smith said that similar pharmacological prevention could control aggressive behavior in human beings after the manner of Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange. American psychologist B.F. Skinner, describing behavior engineering some years ago, said, we have the technology for installing any human behavior we want. And a University of Michigan psychologist, James O'Connell, proposed, quote, and this is an exact quote, we should reshape our society so that we all would be trained from birth to do what society wants us to do, unquote. The techniques are there. There are plenty of scientists who, to get government grants, would do anything the government says. The apparatus is in place. It would require only a change in government to put it into practice. Peter Beckman wrote a couple of years ago in his fine magazine, Access to Energy, quote, Orwell's 1984 will not come true. The West is moving not toward 1984, but toward the brave new world. In Orwell's fascinating vision, men are coerced into a society of slaves. In Huxley's novel, they are conditioned into it. In In a recent speech, a German journalist noted the failure of Soviet propaganda. I guarantee you, he said, there are no communists under 40 in East Germany. The only communists are in the West. To which I, meaning Beckmann, Czechoslovak expatriate, add a guarantee that there are no communists under 40 anywhere in Eastern Europe, and probably very few in the USSR itself. Why? Because the 1984 type of brainwashing does not work. Nobody is so stupid as to believe that American imperialists will kill widows and orphans for profit. Nobody, that is, who is force-fed such nonsense. Why then can large segments of the population in the West be made to believe that evil corporations, driven by lust for profits, will give cancer to anybody in sight, presumably including themselves, as well as future generations? Not, we submit, because of the rankings of the Jane Fondas. They are themselves too 1984-ish to have any lasting effect. They probably just give most people the creeps. But in the brave new world, people are planned for work at urban factories, and they are in childhood shown pictures of flowers in the countryside and then given electric shocks. No need to coerce them into city living as they grow up. They think the country quite naturally. So why do millions in America regard profit and capitalism as dirty words? Why do they distrust science and technology? Why will they let fraudulent charlatans frighten them out of their wits with witches' brew concocted with scientific vocabulary? Because they have been conditioned. No, not by Karl Marx's Capital, but by NBC's Columbo, in which every businessman, subtly and unobtrusively, is a fool, a crook, or both, as he is in virtually every other TV series. For example, see Benjamin Stein's excellent book, The View from Sunset Boulevard. The average American now spends more time working, only more time working and sleeping than he does in front of the conditioning tube. There are a million other examples from the printed media, the movies, textbooks, college courses, every conceivable channel of communication where the conditioning spices are added subtly but persistently. Unquote. That's Peter Beckmann's quote. Now finally, part four. How plausible is this picture of the brave new world? Technology has made much of it possible. Such technology in the hands of governments would be terrifying. What are the actual chances of this happening? I can't say, of course, that nothing of the kind will ever happen. But I do want to mention some severe problems with it. In a brave new world society, whatever the state of technology is, however high, progress is likely very soon to stop. If government controls individuals and creates clones and generates inferior beings to do inferior work, who is going to generate the new ideas that will result in future progress? Government has never been known to be very adept at this enterprise. And unless the brave new world encompasses the whole earth, other societies will arise with fresh new technologies which will leave the brave new world far behind and hopelessly vulnerable. There is just no substitute for individual initiative and enterprise. Computers can only do what people program them to do, and when they need repair or improvement or replacement, ingenious minds must devise these improvements or implant other machines that could one day make computers themselves as obsolete as covered weapons. Only individuals with consciousness and intelligence can do this. Slaves can't, clones can't, even computers can't. And the very intelligence and ingenuity required to constantly improve the technology may also provide the means whereby individuals can outwit, sidestep, make side runs around the machinations of governments. Governments tend to be slow, lumbering dinosaurs, light years behind creative individuals. Computers in private hands can do more. Computers in government's hands have only made a mess of America's social security records. And the computers tend toward decentralization of labor, which keeps people independent of each other. Consider the millions of persons who formerly had to go to work in city offices who can now make their livings and conduct their business through computerized information banks from their own homes. The same technology that governments can use to keep tabs on people, say for tax purposes, or use surveillance against them, can also be used by ingenious individuals to circumvent the dissemination of that information or that surveillance. Let me give just one recent example out of the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago. The new technology has produced trees which grow to full height in 6 months and are stronger than almost any trees They are being grown cheaply and efficiently. Now, imagine what this will do to the price of lumber, and then the housing industry. Multiply this invention by several thousand, and you see what free minds can do, and slaves cannot, to enhance the condition of human life on this planet. The Soviet Union and China, whose systems don't accompany such creative innovation, are ever hungry for Western technology. They're falling behind further each year. China is playing with its free enterprise zones and begging for more Western aid. The Soviets are becoming hysterical in their espionage against Western technology, especially aerospace, computers, communications. Because of this widening technological gulf, Russia's internal pressures are mounting steadily. Its economy is simply unable to come near matching the living standards of the free world. Besides, Russia can't tolerate large information banks. That amount of knowledge just can't be disseminated in a totalitarian state. And ironically, I'm afraid, it's these very pressures that may provoke them to create an external diversion, war, in order to keep themselves in power, a strategy similar to that of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. Even so, we have an advantage if we remain free. Quality will outrank quantity, and quality is what free minds can produce. Even in war, with every year that passes, the outcome will be determined more by the quickness of information acquisition, down to the millisecond, than by quantity of weapons. If we know where their missiles are and precisely when, we can neutralize them. Many experts already think the nuclear age is over and the electronic age has begun. And in that department, the free world has no rival. This is not to say there isn't a great danger in the prospect of a Soviet sudden first strike, since modern war does confer a great advantage on an aggressor. Only that in spite of the enormous war preparations, the West has a great long-run advantage, if there is a long run at all. Yes, the present condition of the world, especially the totalitarian nations controlling population